With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky, okay? I, of course, am Mike Porky Parry. Delighted to be with you again today for another scintillating and invigorating and entertaining and educating podcast. And I'm delighted, absolutely delighted, folks, today to introduce you to a new co-presenter, Mr. Ben the Arrow Fletcher. Ben, thank you very much indeed for joining me today. Tell me about your initial response being in this studio with the Planet Porky crew.
Well, hello, Mike, and hello, everybody. I mean, yeah. I'm absolutely, it's a privilege to be here. It's a pleasure to sit alongside you, as I have
That's
done
very
many,
kind
many
of you.
Times
Thank you.
Elsewhere. I feel we should tell the story of how this actually came about.
Yes.
I was actually flying back from Edinburgh. And,
what were you doing in Edinburgh?
But I was at a wedding.
Oh, you weren't at the festival then?
No. The Fringe started just after I left.
Right.
So I got out before that, all that nonsense started. I'm not really a fan of all that type of thing. But we got back and got to Gatwick, booked a cab via an app. Get a phone call from an unknown number, and I thought, well, this is going to be a guy saying, where do you want to be picked up? Will it be the Sofitel? Will it be here? Will it be there?
So I'm reduced to the ranks of Uber driver, am I?
Well, I answered the phone and said to you, if you remember, hello, mate, where do you want to pick me up? But I hear, hello, Ben, it's Mike Parry here. I'll cut straight to the chase. I've got a proposition for you. I said, so, whoa, hang on a minute. Sorry, I'll have to cut you off. As painful as it is to do so,
I thought you were going to be a cab.
It was unbelievable, but there we go. So we sort of made up, and here we are today. Yeah, real pleasure to be alongside you. Thanks
now,
for having me.
Now, the reason I called you the Arrow, Ben the Arrow Fletcher, is because a Fletcher is an arrow maker, isn't he?
Arrow head maker.
Arrow head maker.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought they put the feathers on the back of the arrow.
It could all be the feathers on the back. I mean, I bow to your superior knowledge.
I don't know. The only reason is that recently a very good friend of yours and mine, Danny Kelly, and I were doing a show together, and there was some anniversary about Agincourt. And of course, Agincourt is one of the greatest military victories in the history of Britain because numerically we were like 1/10 of what the French were, but they galloped across a wet field. Their horses sunk in the field, and our long bowmen had so many arrows they sorted out the enemy. But Danny said, because he knows a lot about military history, for a year before Agincourt, every citizen in England was told to produce 10 arrows for the army. And that's why so many people are called Fletcher.
Yeah, Fletcher. And there's a village called Fletching in Sussex.
Right.
Which I wonder if that's got anything to do with it. You know, Sussex are renowned for involvement with the Battle of Hastings and that type of thing.
Really?
But it's a historical surname. Scottish surname. Very proud of my Scottish roots.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you got any Scottish relatives?
What do you mean, really?
Well, I mean, I didn't know you had any Scots.
Oh, I do. Yeah. My dad's Scottish. It was just that, why am I proud of my Scottish roots?
No, I'm glad. So obviously you went to Edinburgh family wedding and all that. Delighted that you got through that. Now, talking about travelling, okay.
Go on.
I want to talk to you about the French.
Yeah.
Now, you know, obviously at the moment we're still embroiled in Brexit negotiations. The two main powers inside Europe, Germany and France, obviously. Germany, a great economic power. France, more of a political power to me, because strategically, they're just across the channel from us. But why? I don't know how France get away with it. When you look at the league economic tables, they seem to change all the time, whether we are the fifth richest economy in the world or the sixth. And if we're the sixth, then French becomes the fifth, okay?
Yeah.
The problem is, I think we are much more productive in this country. We've got the City of London, right? Massive, massive economic growth generator and all that kind of stuff. France haven't got anything like that. They've got, you know, great farming and all that. Don't think they've got a lot of manufacturing. But what really bugs me is that the French invent rules for the rest of Europe to abide to, but they don't abide to themselves. They couldn't care less.
Of course not.
I mean, you know, have you ever been to France and walked into a bar and thought, oh, I didn't know they allowed smoking inside bars and restaurants anymore? We're doing France. Yeah. It's the French.
It's their own rule.
Yeah.
I flew back from Bordeaux Airport. This is going back about 12 years. And it was at the time when liquids and stuff were a bit dodgy travelling.
Yeah, I know what you mean. They would ban you putting fluids in your
bag. That was it. So I was at Bordeaux Airport, and I'll never forget it, 2006. So I thought, oh, last minute, I better buy the wife a present. Yeah. Been away for a couple of weeks, and I hadn't thought to do it up until that point.
Right.
So I dive into the gift shop, and I buy her this kind of like body cream, body butter, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And it was called Amandé with an E on the end, and her name's Amanda. So I thought,
Amandé.
Oh, quite fitting. Amandé. Yeah, so Amandé nice. Body cream, right?
Yeah. Excellent.
Get to the gate. The guy says, no, I'll take this away. It's it's classic, technically a liquid.
Yes.
And I said, I've just bought this from your gift shop. And then the whole...
Expensively.
It was about 60 euros. It wasn't cheap. You know, it was a guilt present because I left it until the last minute.
Well, what were you doing in France?
I was with some friends. I retired over there. So it was just like a bit of a lad's holiday.
Right.
Not lads in the kind of traditional sense. It was more of a kind of relaxing...
Okay.
I think we did a bit of building work for his friend's parents, but a story for another day, perhaps.
Yeah.
Anyway, the guy all of a sudden lost his grasp of English and tried to take my 60-euro cream and put it into the container with all the other shampoos and waters and such like. I said, no, I'm not having that. Not one bit. So I ended up having to go back through security, back through passport control.
And put it in the hold?
No, not put it in the hold. To get a refund. But then they wouldn't give me a refund. They said, oh, I can't... The lady says, I cannot take money out of the deal.
Mm.
So you can have something else of value. So I bought a ceramic teapot thing, which it was had a little French phrase on it. But then it was more expensive than what the gift I'd bought. So we're in this awkward scenario. The plane is taxiing. I'm literally having to jump on the plane.
Yeah.
And I owe them about 11 euros.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm never flying to Bordeaux again.
No, you won't. You get arrested.
I don't actually think I've been to France
when you get there. But anyway, listen, the reason I raise this is because, as you know, I'm a student of many things, including economics, right?
Yeah.
And economics in Europe as well. What about this? I want your reaction to this story, Ben, right? The French government has promised a crackdown on idling public sector workers after evidence that hundreds are being paid to do nothing, right?
What?
Yeah. Minister said they would end the practice of local government employers receiving full pay for 10 years, even if they do no work at all, and 50% of their salary thereafter. Of these numbers, at least 19 have been identified in the VAR department in Provence, the VAR department. I don't know what VAR is in French.
VAR, well, that's the VAR getting to football department? Technology now, aren't we? Or is that something a little bit different?
Well, no, it's different. It's big VAR department in Provence, southern France, infamous as the bastion of stay-at-home public sector workers.
Yeah.
A recent report by the Regional Audit Office revealed that in 2015... which is the last year for which they have full audited figures, councils in the VAR... Oh, I see. VAR is a district, sorry.
Oh, I see,
VAR is a district. The VAR department in Provence paid a total of €600,000 to 32 employees who have done absolutely no work at all over the last 5 years.
Do you know, you're expecting me to be shocked by that.
Yeah.
But I'm not, because this is a nation that they've never won a war. And a nation who...
Well, is that their fault? I mean, they're landlocked to, places like, you know, Switzerland, Germany and Poland and all that, we're not.
True, but if you think of a Frenchman, you don't think of, you don't think of industry, you don't think of leading from the front, you don't think of people that you'd want alongside you, and pardon the phrase, but in the trenches.
Yeah.
You know, this doesn't surprise me one bit. We're living in an era when, as you said at the start of this show, Brexit negotiations are entering a critical period, things are very difficult.
Yeah.
We are trying to keep our British stiff upper lip and that type of thing.
Yeah.
And here are the French giving money to people for doing absolutely nothing.
No,
they're a nation of layabouts.
Yeah,
there are national layabouts.
Well, national layabouts is a bit strong, but I mean, I'm grasping at straws trying to disagree with this because I don't really want to upset the French. I mean, for instance,
well, why not? What are they?
No, I don't blame you. I mean, for instance, after I've had a few drinks, I never repeat the joke in the pub about why are there palm trees on the Champs Elysees? It's to keep the sun off the German soldiers' heads. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't repeat that joke because I think that's quite offensive to the French. You know what I mean? Who are quite nice people. In fact, I remember once flying on Air France somewhere, and when we got there, we happened to bump into the crew of the plane. It happened to be the Concorde, actually.
And really?
It was South America. And I had a big row with the Concorde pilot about the role of the French in the Second World War. Because my father, of course, war hero,
was
in the Royal Navy at the age of 17, you know, sailing Atlantic convoys and all that kind of stuff. But it's interesting you have, because you're a younger man than me.
Yeah.
And, of course, I've been influenced by what my father told me about the French. But for you to have that attitude that the French are basically a nation of layabouts, I totally agree. And let me tell you this. I've got another backup story here, which might even completely reinforce what you have just said.
Oh, here we go.
An immigrant's request for French citizenship has been rejected because she has been adjudged to work too hard.
Oh, well, there we go then. I didn't know you were about to read
no,
that,
no,
so
no,
I've been
no,
proven
no, no,
right.
No, I didn't tell you I got
no,
this. I was interested in your response to the French in the first place. The woman, a nurse in the Paris region, applied after arriving from the Lebanon. Officials said that her application had been rejected because she worked an average of 67 and a half hours a week in her previous employment in the Middle East. And that is, quotes, in breach of the regulations on working time in France, OK? Now, get this. This completely backs up what you've just said.
Yeah.
In France, the standard working week is 35 hours, one of the shortest in the world.
It is.
Workers are allowed to put in longer hours within limits. The maximum is 44 hours a week, although this can be extended to 48 for short periods in exceptional circumstances if the business is deigned to be going under. But I've seen stories like this all the time. Bakers who want to get up early and start baking their loaves at 4 o'clock in the morning cannot serve bread after 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
It's
it
madness.
Is absolutely outrageous.
But does it surprise you? I mean, again, we are a nation where lunch is for wimps. You know, it goes back to Minder, and funnily enough, I saw some old archive episodes in the studios earlier on
from
Minder.
Yeah.
And you think that's
yeah.
whilst
great
that's
program, it,
oh, very much. And that's one great thing about, you know, when you work the hours that I do, you get home and there's on terrestrial television the old 70s and 80s, nice little throwback to the past. It's great. But I digress. We are a nation where the lunch break is seen as almost frowned upon if you take the full hour. People put in hours, 35 hour weeks, that's Monday to Wednesday. You know what I mean? Never mind the rest of the week. But that pretty much just sums it up. And I don't want to get into a Brexit debate or anything too political at this stage with you, but it doesn't surprise me that the people shouting the loudest and trying to tell us what to do are those who don't enforce their own rules on their own people.
Yeah, I agree. But I don't know how France can be such a wealthy country, fifth or sixth regional, with that sort of attitude. How does it work?
Well, maybe that's the secret. Maybe we care too much. Maybe we're too conscientious. I mean, how many times do we hear as Brits that, you know, we're socially awkward, we worry too much? I mean, how many times, I can think of thousands of scenarios off the top of my head when you'll bump into a mate in the shop and you'll do everything you can to avoid him because it's too socially awkward or on a train. Maybe we care too much. Maybe we're too conscientious.
Maybe.
If we were a little bit more laissez-faire like the French, maybe we wouldn't get more done, but we'd be more productive because we're happier.
But I love France as a country. I believe it or not, I was the Rugby World Cup correspondent, right?
Oh, yeah.
For TalkSport in 2007. That's right, yeah. And I know nothing about rugby. In fact, I didn't even know that the guy I was working with was the famous Australian rugby player, David.
I'm on the team. Yeah. His name will come to me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. I didn't even know.
Until
I looked at the programme at the final.
Exactly what you mean.
And found out he was the third most successful rugby player of all time. You know, he's an Australian guy, but he's working for the South Africans at
it'll
that point.
It'll come to me in a minute.
Yeah, David.
David, it'll come to me. Carry on.
Anyway, what I'm saying is, we went all over France. I spent a lot of time in Paris, and I love Paris. I think the architecture's fantastic. I think the way of life is fantastic. I love the restaurants. My favourite restaurant, believe it or not, the Champs-Élysées, is called Fouquet.
Really?
Which is spelled...
That sounds like you.
Yeah. It's spelled F-O-U-Q-U-E-T, Fouquet.
Yeah.
But they call it Fouquet, you know, and...
You struggle getting that pass off, Com.
you certainly would, yeah. And...
David Campese, by the way.
David Campese was the name, absolutely. I didn't realise who he was until Charlie Sale came up to me and said, can I speak to him? Because we were in some press centre or something, and I looked like David's minder, because we were sitting next to each other, you know, in the press box. And I said, yeah, sure, what do you want to talk to him about? You know, and Charlie looked at me astonished. Charlie's retired now, by the way.
Yeah,
he got a sad illness at the Brazil World Cup. Cup, I think it was.
He did, yeah.
He got many. No, what did he get? It was like blood poison or something. But he was very ill.
He came to TalkSport Towers, and he was a much more gentle character than I imagined him to be.
Yeah, well, an old colleague, and I'm glad he did. But no, I don't have a thing against the French, but I'm very envious that, as you quite rightly say, I couldn't work 35 hours a week without really going into despair and panic about where is my career going.
Yeah.
Because in this country, we are very competitive. And if you're working 35 hours a week, somebody's going to fill that vacuum of those hours that you're not working in a normal 50-hour week that we work in this country. I mean, crikey, some of the hours that you work, sometimes you're out of bed at 4 in the morning, you're in the office at 5, you might be there till 1 or 2 in the afternoon, you might not be home till 4.
Yeah.
I mean, you're absolutely right. You could do 2.5 days a week in France, and that would be it. That would be a lot.
Well, that would be it. And I wonder how the French would react to my current career path. You know, I'm breakfast sports reader on the TalkSport Network. I'm presenting overnight. So a week on Friday, to give you an example, I will be doing the sports breakfast news from 4:30 in the morning until midday. I'll go home. I'll sleep for as long as I can, deal with my domestic situation, which is a wife and two kids, put them to bed. The kids, that is not the wife. She does what she likes, pretty much. I'll then come back into work for 10, 11 o'clock and work through the night and then go to sleep again, and sometimes I'll be up again at 3 o'clock the following morning to go back to my normal shift pattern.
Absolutely.
I'm happy with that. My body can cope with it. I know that you have to work hard and put them in a bit of a good old fashioned blood, toil, sweat and tears to get what you want in life, but would the French allow that? I'd probably be deported for that sort of behaviour.
I've not been to much of France except Paris.
So I think Paris is overrated.
You think
I've never been to Paris, but,
really great. Yeah, I love going into
Paris. Should I go there?
I would, honestly, for the experience. Really? I'd go to the Gare du Nord, right, which is the Eurostar tunnel.
Yeah.
And I think it's got the same sort of problem that lots of metropolises have. It's got beggars all over the place and all that, but you have to get through all that. And we stayed in a hotel right opposite the Mercure. It wasn't a great hotel, but there were 20 of us there, you know, covering a World Cup. You couldn't stay in a 5-star hotel. But then I would walk down to our other hotel where our studios were, which was the Hilton near the Eiffel Tower.
Eiffel Tower.
And it was fantastic. And it was great going on the, you know, the left bank of the river and, you know, Champs-Élysées, all that kind of stuff. Really brilliant. I love it. And then I've been to the south of France, but not often. But that's overrated, in my view.
So you and I have completely opposite views.
Right.
I've never been to Paris.
Right.
And I said to my wife the other day, because there's talk that we might go to Disneyland with the kids.
Yeah.
And that doesn't interest me one bit.
No.
I'd rather go to Florida, because I love America.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll talk about that in a little while.
Yeah.
But I want to see more of America. But as far as France goes, I think the south of France is beautiful.
Yeah.
The story I told you earlier on about Bordeaux Airport, we were staying in a little town just outside of Saintes, which is one of the most romantic French towns you can imagine.
Right.
Like, you know, sort of trees overhanging the pavements, old-fashioned shop frontage. Probably, you know, Victorian 1920s, 1930s.
Yeah.
There's a river. There's a big arch. It's all very architecturally lovely. And you feel like you're on holiday. You feel like it's the sort of place you go and have a nice, long, languishing lunch or dinner, or maybe both.
Yeah.
But Paris just doesn't interest me one bit. I could go back to Saintes every weekend for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
But if I never go to Paris, I don't feel like I'd miss out.
I'm glad to hear
just
that.
Just my view.
Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Delighted to say that I have with me today Ben the Arrow Fletcher. Ben, thanks for being with me today.
Privilege.
Interesting what you say about Paris and France and all that. But earlier on, when we were talking in this podcast, you made reference to the fact that you like going home and you scan a lot of 70s and 80s type programmes on the telly. Now, I'm a much older man than you, right?
Yeah.
I am in early middle age now, probably in my sixth decade or something like that. You're much younger, but I didn't know that those programmes appeal to people your generation. I'll tell you why they appeal to me.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember Oxford Street. Well, I can't because I didn't live in London, but I can remember when you could drive your Volvo and you could park outside Selfridges and there were no yellow lines or, you know, traffic, what do you call them,
meters.
Traffic warns or meters. And you'd go in and buy something, come out again, get in your car and drive off. I remember when Triumph Heralds were the most popular vehicle on the car. And I can remember when, you know, life seemed to go at an awful lot slower pace. Like, for instance, if you watch Heartbeat or something like that, than it does now. Now, it appeals to me because as a child, I can look back and say it was better in the old days. It wasn't, by the way. You know, we didn't have mobile phones. We didn't have more than three channels on the television.
Wireless internet.
Yeah, we had cars that went a maximum of 60 or 70 miles an hour. We didn't have motorways when I was first born and all that. But for some unknown reason, I love the nostalgia because I was around in those days. Why do you like it?
Well, I think for a lot of the reasons that you've mentioned, I mean, for me, late 80s, early 90s, so things like A Touch of Frost, when David Jason walks down a high street and you see all the old shop brands, like Woolworths. So I mean, if you've ever heard me present an Extra Time show on Talk Sport, it always ends up coming back to Woolworths and how you can't buy CDs or pick and mix anymore. But it was an era of innocence. Mm. And a lot of the things that you've mentioned there, mobile phones, you know, internet, data, everything being a lot more in your face in the modern era with things like social media, it feels like it was an age where people just got on with life.
Yes.
And I remember growing up, I'm 35, so I was born in 84, my first real memories, and you're looking at me thinking, Christ, he's old. It was an uphill paper round with cobbles. But I'll move on. It was an age of innocence. It was very much just nice. And I think as well, when you look at programmes like Mind Up, and I don't remember the late 70s, early 80s, I wasn't around, but it's almost a bit like a history lesson. And I don't mean that in a patronising way.
No, I agree.
Like Fawlty Towers, when he walks down the high street trying to catch the major, who's a crook.
Yes.
Polly Watt walks past, the waitress walks past all of these old shops and all the old cars are driving past.
Yes.
It's just lovely.
Yes.
And I don't think I'm alone. I've always been old beyond my years anyway. I've got a massive vinyl collection. I love 70s and 80s music.
Yeah.
That's just me. Take it or leave it.
Yeah.
But as far as the telly's concerned, it's just it feels like a little cuddle from the past. Mm. And that might sound a little bit crap, but that's honestly how I feel about it. I mean, a lot of modern soaps and a lot of modern programs that you watch, you sort of think, well, okay, there's so much telly now that you just can't catch up with things. I've never seen Game of Thrones. I've never seen a lot of popular TV.
Yeah.
Some things I have, but others you can't keep up with it all. Mm. But everybody watched Heartbeat, and I'm glad you mentioned that,
because
the maudlin Yorkshire, you know, you can smell the petrichor.
That's right.
Do you know what that word means,
petrichor? No, I don't know.
Petrichor is the smell of rain on hot ground.
Oh, lovely.
So that lovely smell you get when you water the plants in the summer.
Yeah, sure.
You can smell the kind of, and Heartbeat was all about Sunday night. So maybe it makes you feel like being a kid again.
Yeah,
maybe. And that's the appealing factor.
Maybe it does. Maybe that is the appealing factor. And some of those shows as well remind me that life wasn't competitive in those days. Now, perhaps, you know, it's a weakness in me to saying you want to live in an uncompetitive world. I don't. I've always lived in a competitive world. But what I'm saying is, these days, officialdom is absolutely above itself in the way it controls our lives.
Mm.
Because it never used to cost £4.50 to park for 2 hours in a parking space in any town in this country, which has done a lot towards killing off high streets and all that. You used to park, and in those days it would cost you £2 all day and that kind of stuff. And then what's happened in the recent decades is that local authorities have decided to milk the individual. Whereas local authorities used to be set up to cope and cater with the living in a town and help the residents to live in that town, they don't. They're now their masters. And it's outrageous. It's outrageous, the business rates they charge, what they charge for parking, what they charge for removing your rubbish and all that. And in the days I'm talking about, a policeman wouldn't arrest you. He'd cuff you across the ear if you were a teenager and he found you climbing out of a garden where you'd been stealing apples or something like that. You know what I mean?
It would be all about, we're all here, we're all just trying to get on.
Yep.
There are things that need to be dealt with. There are crimes that need to be addressed and there are bad people out there that need to be dealt with. And it was the same back then as it is now.
Yep.
Probably more poignant now than it was back then, you may argue. But but you're right. And the high street versus the council. I mean, how often do we hear? You mentioned £4.50 to park your car for a couple of hours.
Yeah.
You go somewhere like Guildford in Stockbroke-about Surrey,
right.
You know, quite close to me.
Right.
I mean, that will probably do about half an hour. And you go down to Brighton, on the south coast, all right, very touristy area, but you're talking £25 to park your car for the day.
And in central London, £60.
Exactly.
Yes.
I refuse to go to Brighton now. Yeah. My wife's desperate to go. Oh, the sun's out. She'll go down with the boys.
It costs that much to park in Brighton?
Some of the,
how much for a day?
Oh, £25.
£25?
I'm not making that up. I mean, you are lucky if you can find a private bay underneath like a block of flats down towards Hove for a tenner. And I go with young children. And
I was going to say, you take your kids out for a day on Brighton Beach or Hove Beach or something like that. And in Brighton, by the way, there's a lot of car parks near the front. They're underground
as well. They're the ones,
That's right. And they're £25 a day.
Some of them are, yeah.
It's outrageous.
And that's like, you know, NCP, for example, or some of the council car parks. And you think you're better off getting the train. But then, of course, Southern Rail and Thames Link, who we all know very well for being two of the worst run rail companies probably in the world, never mind the UK, make it all the more difficult. But Brighton's another overrated place. I think
I think it's a bit of a dump.
It is a dump.
I do. I think the first thing
you notice, this car park we parked in, so we got the pushchair out. I had one boy at this point, not two. This was a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
He was about 9 months old, but not that that's relevant, but just to give you a bit of context. So pushchair comes out, been a bit of a journey, screamed the whole way. I'm already feeling a little bit up against it. I've just had to pay 20-odd quid to park my car.
Yeah.
And I was really walking down the beach thinking, right, I need an ice cream or something a little bit stronger probably.
Yeah.
And we walked down at the seafront and I remember just thinking, God, the sea smells a little bit bad today.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the sea at all. It was like the detritus on the ground. You know those arches where some of the bars are?
I do.
And it just smelt like, I want to use the word like disease. Mm. It was horrible. It was like spilt beer and sick and just unclean.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is like one of the premier, Brighton's a city, isn't it?
Yeah.
City status.
Yeah.
One of the premier cities on the South Coast, very much. And yet I'm walking down and I was almost heaving. And my wife said, God, there must be something in the sea, but it wasn't. It was the smell of the ground.
God.
And this, granted, this was early on a Sunday morning, so maybe the street cleaners hadn't been out. But I just thought, again, very overrated city.
Yeah.
And people in Brighton, generally, in my experience, they're very quick to tell you that they live in Brighton. They're very proud of the area.
Mm.
Well, maybe if they didn't leave rubbish about, and maybe if they actually sort of treated their streets with a bit of respect, maybe it would be worth parking your car for 20 quid a day.
Isn't there this famous comeback? Do you live in Brighton? Hove, actually.
Yeah,
because Hove is supposed to be even more posh, isn't it?
Well, we have a colleague who we won't name, but there was somebody who I know who said that exact thing.
Is that right?
Where she lived, yeah.
Oh, really? Much. Hove, actually. That's right, yeah.
God love her.
And Rodine School is there, isn't it?
The
famous girls' school, where I think Princess Anne went. One seaside town I do like enormously, because my family live there, is Bournemouth.
Love Bournemouth.
Bournemouth is fantastic. It's fantastically clean. But it's also a very wealthy town, you see.
It is.
So they charge very high sort of, council tax rates and they've got a very efficient system. You'd never, ever get that sort of smell you're talking about down on the beach in Brighton. Funnily enough, my niece, who was brought up there, spent 1 year as a lifeguard, like a Baywatch lifeguard, you know, put the old jacket on, rushing into the sea, you know, to rescue kids in rubber rings, all that kind of stuff. She actually didn't do any work at all, but it was great.
Of course not.
Great, you know. Sort of.
But she would have done it. You've got to be ready in a job like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's all very
absolutely.
Well doing the Baywatch photos.
Well, she's a very good swimmer, actually. She does this open sea swimming and all
does
that,
she?
Or lake swimming, or what's it called? Freshwater swimming.
Freshwater
or something.
Swimming, yeah.
Well, she goes. Because I don't live very far from what's her name? You know, where Harry Redknapp lives.
Sandbanks.
Yeah. Thank you. She goes down there on Sunday mornings when she goes back to see her mum, and she'll swim for 3 or 4 miles around Sandbanks Bay. And and it's great. There is another form of swimming, which is river and lake swimming, but that's very bad for you because so much stuff gets into your mouth. And do you know what they have to do?
It can kill you.
It can kill you. And what they have to do is they have to drink Coca-Cola all the time to kill off all the microbes which they take in. And I know a young lady, and so do you, who does it. She's one of the newsreaders at TalkSport. Is it Shona, is her name? Or
Shona McCarthy, weekend newsreader.
She's very slim and fit and got longish hair, but she does these things where you do three particular events, cycling, running.
A triathlon.
Yeah. And she says they swim in lakes and you have to be very careful what you're taking through your mouth, you know?
Well, you do very much. Effectively, it's like swimming in a toilet.
Yeah.
Well, if you go in the sea, we all know not to drink seawater because it's got salt in it.
Exactly.
But some of the other things, if you go in a pool, it's chlorinated.
Somebody does
a wee in the pool in the corner, you think, well, that's disgusting, but the chlorine will take care of it. Mm. You're in the open sea, you're on your own, pal.
Oh, yeah, I know, yeah. And it's not something I would get onto. But anyway, Bournemouth's a lovely town.
It is.
Now,
very
I'm going to shock you now by bringing to your attention a syndrome which I don't think you will have ever heard of. Okay,
go on.
A 27-year-old Nottingham secretary has become the first white woman to develop Koro syndrome. Do you know what Koro syndrome is?
I've never heard of it in my life.
Right. Koro syndrome is a psychiatric condition which up until now has only been traced to sufferers being African men who believe their genitals are disappearing.
Wow. That's deep.
That's Corot syndrome. Corot syndrome.
I've never heard of that in my life.
No.
So she thinks that her genitals are disappearing.
Yeah.
Now, I understand the kind of male point of view in that, because you have actual external genitals to show.
Exactly, yeah.
But from a female point of view, I won't paint you a picture, but what is there to disappear? That's really quite staggering.
I did a bit of research on this, because obviously I read my journals assiduously.
You're a scholar, I understand something.
I have to... But it's kind of psychiatrically linked to the fact that you don't think you're going to be able to have sex anymore in a year or two, because you won't have the physical facilities in your body to be able to enable you to go through the physical process.
Yeah.
And it's very serious and is apparently very commonplace in parts of Africa. And also, horrendously, in parts of Africa, when these poor guys get this terrible thought in their head, they actually then take action themselves. If it's going to happen, it might as well happen now anyway. And then you've got self-mutilation.
That's terrible.
And all this kind of thing. Now, normally speaking, it's not the sort of thing I'd want to talk about on Planet Porky.
Well,
you know what I mean?
It's a serious issue.
It's a serious issue.
Where was this lady from? Sorry, this lady?
This lady is from Nottingham.
Oh, so it's affected the UK. This is exactly what I'm saying.
So normally I wouldn't have got into such a, what you might call a bizarre and fairly distant sort of health condition. But it's now come to the UK. It's the first one in the... in the UK, and I urge everybody to take an interest in this, because we all know what happens. Once you get one case of anything in this country, people then psychologically start to question their own, their own susceptibility
to
getting this sort of thing. And if it's a mental condition as well, it can so easily become a disease. I mean,
indeed. You
know, how often, perhaps you haven't because you're only a young man, you're only 35, but often during my life I've thought, I think I've got an aneurysm in my head. Now, why would I think that? Only because, you know, I sort of might have stood up and felt lightheaded or something like that, or I might have felt particularly tired one morning. And in fact, I had a mate who, when he was 45, died of an aneurysm.
Mm.
You know, standing in the kitchen, holding a glass of wine, a glass of whiskey. His girlfriend was cooking the spag bol. He just collapsed and died. And when the post-mortem came, he had an aneurysm in the back of his head. I think Karen Brady had an aneurysm in the back of her head.
And nearly killed her there.
You know, which was picked up by a medical condition. So once you get it in your head, you might have something. It can become extremely worrying. So that's one to watch for.
Especially when it's close to you and with something like that. I mean, so I would urge every man and woman of the age of consent and above, in case you have got this, go home and make hay while the sun shines. Why take the risk? You know, so go home and enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
And if you are ever befouled by this terrible illness,
that's right.
Rojo disease, did you say it was called?
Rojo. Koro.
I was going to say, I'm thinking of the Manchester United player.
You are,
Marco Rojo.
It's called Koro syndrome. But it's purely a psychiatric condition. The problem is that you take it on upon yourself then to either try and stop it happening or you speed it up. So that you can
accept it
and take the mental pressure off your head. You know, if you go to bed at night, will I wake up in the morning? Will my genitals have disappeared? I know. If I do something I don't have to worry about it. Talking about those, we've talked just a few minutes ago about the old programme, 70s and 80s, and you said the high streets and all this. What about this report I've got here? Many children have never been to traditional shops such as butchers or greengrocers, and some have no idea what a high street is. Nearly a third of those aged 5 to 11, does that include your children's
age
group? Not quite, right. Had never visited a butcher's shop, nearly a quarter had not been to a greengrocer, and 44% had not visited a florist.
I think that's really sad. And again, people's habits change.
Yeah.
And we as often as we can, I live in Reigate now, which is east of Surrey, not far from
Gatwick
Airport. Yeah, it's got a high street. It's a successful high street.
Yeah.
So, I mean, shops come and go sometimes. There's a lot of independent traders. You get chain restaurants.
Yeah.
You get independent local restaurants, coffee shops. So a bit of a mixture of everything.
Yeah.
But there's a local butcher, and there's a couple of local butchers.
Yeah.
There's no fishmonger, and there's no greengrocer. But then I don't really think you get traditional greengrocers in many places anymore.
Yeah.
But we always try and go to the butchers to get, like, good meat for a barbecue or a steak or whatever it might be.
I don't
But But how sad is that? Because it's not just buying the produce. No. It's not just buying the meat. It's the interaction with the butcher.
Yeah, of course it is.
So my son's watched me have a chat with a guy, and you're talking about the local business, the local affairs, the town, how's it all going?
Yeah.
You show a bit of an interest. And I want my sons to see that, or daughters, if I had daughters, and sort of this is how you you approach things. This is how you don't just click order on an internet basket and have it delivered to your house by a delivery driver. You actually go out, you support local business, and more to the point, you interact with people. No, it's a bit more expensive, but more enriching.
I totally agree. And the state of the high street these days in some prosperous towns, even in Surrey, where you and I live down in Stockbroker Belt.
Yeah.
Shops are emptying, and it's all to do with Amazon. And I saw a documentary the other night, an Amazon warehouse the size of an aircraft hangar.
It is.
And almost totally controlled by robots who pick things off shelves and put them in boxes. And I mean, it's amazing.
It is amazing and scary because the argument of Amazon used to be, well, we're employing people in our warehouses.
Right.
And I saw a documentary once, and it's not just them. There are other internet providers who, you know, these guys are working and girls are working long hours.
Yeah.
It's very, very quick. It's very, very frantic. It's one job to the other. You have to, you know, complete a certain number of jobs in a certain time space.
Mm.
But we're all guilty of it.
Yeah.
Because you walk past the bookshop on the high street, you think, oh, I'll get the Ainsley Harriet cookbook in the Caribbean, whatever it might be for my mother or whatever, and the new Jack Reacher book for my dad. And you look at the price. And we all do it subconsciously. We go, I'll see how much it is on the internet.
Yeah,
you save £3, it's delivered to your house. You haven't got to pay for parking, which we know is very, very expensive. You haven't got to go out in the rain, but you save yourself a bit of money. We're all guilty. I'm guilty,
and
you probably are too.
We are, I agree.
Brexit negotiations are entering a critical period. Things are very difficult.
Yeah.
We are trying to keep our British stiff upper lip and that type of thing.
Yeah.
And here are the French giving money to people for doing absolutely nothing.
No,
they're a national layabout. They're a national layabout.
Well, national layabout is a bit strong, but I mean, I'm, you know, grasping at straws trying to disagree with it because I don't really want to upset the French. I mean, for instance...
Well, why not? What are they?
I don't blame you. I mean, for instance, you know, after I've had a few drinks, I never repeat the joke in the pub about, you know, why are there palm trees on the Champs-Élysées? It's to keep the sun off the German soldiers' heads, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't repeat that joke because I think that's quite offensive to the French, you know what I mean, who are quite nice people. In Brighton, by the way, there's a lot of car parks near the front. They're underground as well.
They're the ones,
That's right. And they're £25 a day.
Some of them are, yeah.
It's outrageous.
That's like, you know, NCP, for example, or some of the council car parks. And, and you think you're better off getting the train. But then, of course, Southern Rail and Thames Link, who we all know very well for being two of the worst run rail companies probably in the world, never mind the UK, make it all the more difficult. But Brighton's another overrated place. I think
I think it's a bit of a dump. My favourite restaurant, believe it or not, the Champs-Élysées, is called Phuket.
Really?
Which is spelled...
That sounds like you.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.